Hey, good morning. It's Scott Pianowski, and I'm back with the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast, Monday, July 29th. And we have an outstanding episode coming. Sammy Reed, Fantasy Insiders, is going to be with us. But before we get into that, I just want to mention some personal news. It's been on my mind for a couple of days, and I just wouldn't be a human being if I didn't do this. Rob Tuzay has been a really good friend of mine for a couple of decades. We share a fantasy baseball league and a lot of common friends we grew up with together. You may or may not know Rob. He works for SiriusXM as a fantasy producer. He's been a longstanding part of their community. And recently, he just had the second child born into his family. His wife, shortly after that, became ill and passed away this past weekend. I just want to say, Rob, you're in our thoughts. This podcast is dedicated to you. And as it's appropriate to share more details and maybe some support issues, how we can help Rob, I will share that on my Twitter account anyway. Rest in peace to Rob's wife. And, with heavy hearts, we're going to move on and do what we do. Sammy Reed, my man, as I was telling you before we started here, when they gave me this podcast and I was trying to figure out who I'd want to have on the show, you were high up on the list. You're a two-time Fantasy Sports Writer Association Award winner. You had a tweet storm last year about running backs and starting pitchers that I thought was so good it deserved its own FSWA award. You're one of the fine members of the family over at Fantasy Insiders, Sammy Reed, R-E-I-D-F-I on Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us. Good morning.
Dude, of course, Scott. I really appreciate you having me on. I've literally listened to every episode of this podcast. I think it's really great. I think your guests are good, and I just hope that I can, keep the bar high.
I'm sure you will. Sammy also has an extensive poker background, and that's going to be a big theme of today's show. And I'll just tell you up front that we're going to do a Rounders-related draft. We're going to be drafting things from Rounders at the end of this pod. And this might even be the shortest baseball segment we have, because I just want to make sure we have enough time to talk about Rounders.
Yeah, we will talk like 70% poker on this podcast, 100%.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I like the sound of that. And it's funny. A lot of times I come up with a huge script for these podcasts. I want to make sure I don't run out of things to talk about. I think I wrote down like four things I wanted to ask you, and I figured that would probably be enough. And let's start with poker. Talk a little bit about your poker background, and let's talk about some of the poker and fantasy parallels that we can draw. Give us a sense of where you're coming from on the felt.
Yeah, so when I was a little bit younger, back in my 20s, I played online for a job. I played professionally, and I think that's really true with a lot of DFS players. A lot of DFS players, it attracts the same kind of people that like poker, and I did that for a couple of years, and then, as you know, 2011 – Black Friday happened, and all of a sudden the government took away that as like a legitimate career in the United States anyway. And for, I don't know, like 7 years, poker was not a real big part of my life. I like went straight and got a job and started a career and all this stuff. And last year I really started getting back into poker. I like moved pretty close to a local card room, and I just went one day on a whim. I took a couple $100 and I was like, oh, I'll play poker. And I mean, literally, like Mike McDermott in Rounders, I felt alive for the first time in years. And I was like, God, I can't believe I haven't been doing this. And I just started going more and more often and more and more often. You know, now I'm at the point where I'm playing like 15, 20 hours a week consistently. And, you know, it's like a huge part of my life. And I spend so much time studying it and going over it and working out strategies. And I'm just like fully back in, and it's been great. It's been a big addition to my life and a huge passion for me.
Yeah. I guess the reason why I see the fantasy spillover is because they're both, it's about game theory. It's about how to break something down. It's about choices you make and opportunity costs. Yeah, I've become a regular player in one of the local card rooms in Michigan. I'm certainly not doing it professionally, but you know, I've shown a profit for a couple of years, make a little extra money. I think one of the most important things you can do as a poker player or even as a fantasy player is to be realistic about how good you are. I joke that everybody in the poker room thinks they're better than they really are. But when I first went to the room that I go to, I was playing in the limit game, in the 3-6 limit game, which is something I would think would be kind of dreadful and boring now. But they had a 1-2 no limit game, and they used to call it 100-200 because those were – I think at the time you had to buy in for 100 and 200 was the maximum. Yeah. And I was so clueless at the time. I thought it was a 100-200 limit game. I thought you had to sit down with
– nosebleed.
Yeah, I just thought, you know, there's Doyle Brunson to my left and Emeril Slim to my right. I was so clueless. I thought, wow, I'll never have the money to play in that game. And then I realized, no, actually, this is a lot more interesting. And I think it was Jeff Erickson who once compared a straight draft to limit poker and an auction draft. It always seems like a weird phrase to me, to no limit poker. But anyway, I've often toyed with writing an article about how poker can help us with fantasy and vice versa. And I think one of the things I think about is that in poker, it's very important. Every game obviously is different. And just like in fantasy, you know, every answer is contextual and every poker game is contextual. And it depends on who you're playing against, how much money they have, what's happened recently, who's in a good mood, who's in a bad mood, obviously where you are at the table, blah, blah, blah. But one thing I think definitely ties into both games from a game theory standpoint is the idea of selective aggression. That my best strategy is not, I'm not the most aggressive player, although if I were a table with eight rocks, I would probably become the most aggressive player at that table because it would just be the right move, I think, at that time. But I think of what you do in fantasy with Fab, where you might, if you see a player you like in May and you have to blow most of your Fab money for it, you know, maybe it's worth it. Maybe Jordan Alvarez was worth it when he came up to the Astros and you saw you had the potential to hit 15 or 20 home runs. So I think selective aggression is something that applies well to both games. Can you tie in some other things that you think from your poker playing has made you a better fantasy player, or some of your fantasy elements you take to poker? How can we link these two things?
For sure. And I think that selective aggression is a really good point. You know, I think of poker players, it's a lot of, I think poor poker players play a lot of hands at a very low intensity, and a lot of good players play fewer hands at a very high intensity, right? That's selective aggression. And I think we see the same thing in Fab, right? There are people that just, you know, make $10, $15, $20 bids every week, and they just like fill out their roster. And then there's players that, yeah, they take their big shots on guys like Jordan and Austin Riley. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. But, you know, I think Fab is one of these things that I'm certainly trying to get better at. And when I see the best Fabbers out there, guys like, you know, Vlad Sedler and Rob Silver and these guys, they're really selectively aggressive in their spots and they're not afraid to throw haymakers when they see it fit. So I think that's a really good comp. And something else you mentioned, I think we should go into. I wrote a couple things down. You were talking about the best players being honest self-examiners. I remember when I first started, you remember the first World Series of Poker podcast when Moneymaker won it back in, I think, 2003.
Sure, 2003.
You're right. So they were doing all those little interviews in between. And I don't know if you remember Dutch Boyd. He was this guy that sure made a pretty late run. But he said something on that broadcast that like always stuck with me when they were doing the little interview. And he said, look, poker's like sex. Everybody thinks they're great at it. But the truth is, most people have no idea what they're doing. And that's, I think that's true today. And I think that the best poker players and the best fantasy players are really honest self-examiners. They aren't slaves to their ego. I mean, how many poker players do you know that they're always complaining about their bad luck and their bad beats, and they're completely unable to just say, look, I played it wrong. I played bad. They can't be honest with themselves because their ego is like too fragile to admit fallibility. And I think the best players are very honest about when they've played a hand poorly. And, you know, when they go home, they don't, you know, shield themselves. They say, okay, I did this wrong. They think about it. They analyze it. They learn from it. That's how you get better. And I think the same is very true with fantasy players. They don't just have this huge ego and think, yeah, I'm the best. And when I lose, oh, my guys got injured, it was bad luck. They figure out their leaks and they patch them. They constantly challenge their own beliefs. They're not afraid to take the L. And when they do, they go back to the lab and they figure out how they're going to improve. That's what the best players do.
Yeah, that's a great answer. It also makes me think of one thing I'm doing in both disciplines, whether it be poker or fantasy, is I have a small little network, a little salon of people who I really respect. Twitter's great for this, of course, but I do it privately as well. I'll say, hey, this is how I played a hand. How would you have played this? And it's not even hands you lose sometimes. Sometimes it's, you know, did I play this hand that I won too aggressively and cost myself money? Or was I too patient here? Did I give myself exposure that I didn't need to do? Find the people that you respect, your friends, your colleagues, you know, somebody you may know from a league or from Twitter, whatever, and talk about different choices you could have made. And a lot of these things aren't going to have concrete answers, but it's through this community, I think, sometimes, and sharing and soundboarding and just, you know, the exchange of ideas where we can all get better.
100%. I have a really good friend who I constantly send hands to, and he sends hands to me. He lives in LA, you know, he plays 5'10 and above. He's a really, really good player. And so I respect his opinion. And yeah, that back and forth, okay, like, should I have check raised here? Should I be folding this hand pre? All those things. And it's kind of, you check yourself. And yeah, having people that you respect their opinions and you think they're going to lead you the right way, I think is great. And I think the more you think about these things, you don't just do them, you think about them. You know, it's like exercising a muscle. And the more you do that, I think the stronger you get.
Right. And just the mindfulness is always a big part of these things. And also, I think we learn in fantasy, in poker, that as much, look, we're going to live emotional lives on some level. It's just a matter of the way things are. When you hit on a running back or you hit on a starting pitcher or you pick a closer on speculation and he ends up with the job, it feels good. You get a dopamine rush. But our best decisions, I always feel, are tied to being relaxed and being unemotional. A lot of times for me at poker, I'll have music and headphones with me, not because I'm trying to pretend I'm some faux poker pro, but I'm just trying to put myself in a good place. I'm trying to listen to music that relaxes me and enables me to make good decisions. And coincidentally, that's something I do a lot in my fantasy life with when I write or when I'm drafting. A lot of times I'm listening to music because I just want to be at peace and as unemotional and calm as I can to make good choices. Anything from the emotional side or from that mental side tie in either fantasy or poker, things that you do to get the best version of Sammy Reid?
You know, I think that one thing that helps with emotions is to be prepared. And so, like, one of the things that I think that really good poker players do and good fantasy players do is they really work out their strategies off the table or away from the draft, not during play. So, like, bad poker players, I think they tend to do things haphazardly and they do things out of emotion, right? They will bluff on a whim or because they don't like somebody or they're mad at somebody or they'll three bet with rags because, you know, they're tired of this guy raising all those things. Good players have those ideas already worked out beforehand. They know what kind of situations and board textures they're going to use as three barrel bluffs. They have specific hands that they like to use as light three bets, etc. And then in game, they make small adjustments off those well thought out strategies based on like in-game dynamics, just like you'll adjust during the draft. But you're not just doing things because of emotion, right? You already have these strategies worked out. And I think that that helps me keep my emotions out of it when I've already thought about things. If you're just doing things haphazardly, I think that's where you really let emotion come into play. And I think that's one of those things we talk about separating ego. I think that's a huge way to separate ego and kind of get the best out of yourself.
Yeah, I like that phrase, separating ego. It's certainly to be the best you can be. It's something you need to try to do. And as you were giving that another really good answer, I was thinking about a lot of games. Chess is like this, Scrabble's like this. I think fantasy and poker are like this. There's a lot of pattern recognition. Obviously, every situation is different, but there's going to be a lot of constant overlaps where I've been in this situation. It's a heads up pod. I'm in position. The board is a certain texture, and fantasy's like that, where you have a certain draft slot. Your roster construction has started a certain way. Maybe you went early with a tight end, and that's changed the way you have to approach running back and receiver. But the point is, there are common themes and patterns that will show up over and over and over again. And as you said, as you work through those things away from the competitive element, you'll be in a better position when the clock's running down. You need to make a decision because you've already worked out the problem to some degree in your mind.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think something you touched on also in terms of pattern recognition, I think the number one thing that helps you out in poker and helps you out in fantasy is thinking in terms of probability and not absolutes, right?
Ranges, sure.
Yeah, like a poker example, say you're in a heads up pot versus a nit and there's 500 bucks in the pot and you bluff 500 bucks into it on the river. You know that this doesn't need to work every time. You know that this only needs to work 50% of the time or more to be profitable over the long term. And based on the way the guy's played the hand, you think he's got like a marginal hand, he's probably not going to call a lot. But every so often you'll be wrong. Like every so often he'll have a much bigger hand than you're expecting, or maybe he'll surprise you and hero call you with a marginal hand, but you accept this going in that it's not going to work every time. Overall, if he calls 20% of the time, it's still profitable. but you know, it's just not an absolute. And I think it's the same thing in fantasy. I know you're like a big believer in like not drafting injured pitchers, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. This is a thing I hear you talk about all the time, and you don't want to draft them at ADP. At some point, maybe it's okay, but in general, it's not a good idea. So once in a while, you're going to miss out on like Clayton Kershaw this year, who started off hurt. He's been fine. But most of the time, you're going to avoid Luis Severino and Rich Hill and Jimmy Nelson. Once in a while, it won't work out. But overall, it's a winning strategy. And you accept that occasionally you'll miss out on a player, but that's okay. You're not living in that fear. You know, probability wise, if you consistently kind of follow this path, overall, you're going to end up ahead.
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, another thing I try to, but by the way, if you hear a dog barking in the background, that's my dog Fenway, who yes, was named after a ballpark.
It's a great
and
name.
He's a very big fan of the podcast. You know, another thing you tied into that situation, the heads up pot, where you can often make a call where you don't even have to be right anywhere close to 100% to 50% of the time for it to be a profitable move. That happens a lot of times in fantasy, where I think people will get lost in the weeds of, oh, maybe, first of all, it's really hard to know what the true percentage or probability of anything working out is with a move. We can only kind of estimate it. And sometimes I don't want to get tied into things like that. But sometimes people might see a free agent move and think, okay, this doesn't have a very high probability of being a positive move for me. This trade doesn't have a high possibility of working out. But you have to see the implied odds that what if it does work out? Okay, what if you knew you could make a pickup that would cost the rest of your fab, and it had maybe this player had like a 20, this is a, you know, an example that you won't really have it be this portable in real life. But let's just say you had a 20% chance of a move working out. And if it did, your odds of winning the league would be go through the roof. Okay. Some people might say, hey, this is an 80% chance of blowing up my face and ruining my season. Yeah. But you're having a 20% chance to significantly improve your winning odds. It might be worth considering. And I think fantasy players need to understand that we're not looking at that something based on, okay, well, how likely is this to be good or bad? I mean, a lot of the players you pick up off the waiver wire will not help you, but you have to see what the implied odds are. You got to see what can go right and understand that something can be far less than 50% likely to work, but still be worth it because maybe you're increasing your plus EV in the long run.
I completely agree. And I think we're seeing especially this kind of explosive element in the large pool contests. You know, something like the Scott Fish Bowl, where there's 1,200 entrants, or TGFBI, the Great Fantasy Invitational, where there's several hundred, is that you want to increase that variability, right? It's just like a DFS GPP, where, you know, you're not just looking to finish in the middle. What you're looking for is something that can pay off hugely. And so you want to tailor your strategies to be a little more risky, because who cares if you finish 15th or 105th. Nobody remembers if you finish top 10. Nobody cares. They only care if you finish number one. And so it's okay to like take lower probability risks if they have a bigger reward. And I think the size of your league and those, especially those big leagues with several hundred people, the NFBC main event, you want to take more risks there.
Yeah. Yeah. How many times do we see it where a team, say in a football game, an NFL game, will be a heavy underdog, and they'll play conservatively, so afraid that they're going to give the game to the more talented team. And what they need to be doing, again, the selective aggression, is increasing the volatility of the game. Okay. And when you're playing, when you're the weaker person, okay, and you're playing conservatively, you're playing right into the hands of the other side who has more talent or has an advantage, or you know, maybe they have a lead or they have a chip advantage over you, they have a fantasy lead, whatever it is. Yet you need to be more conservative generally with a lead, although there may be times where it makes sense to, you know, keep putting up points or keep being aggressive. And when you're behind, you usually need to think more about a Hail Mary.
Absolutely. And I think that ties back into being honest with yourself, right? And taking ego out of it. It's like, okay, if you're playing heads up with a guy, he's a better player than you, you should recognize that. Like, you're not the best poker in the player in the world. I'm not the best in the world, right? There are going to be people that are better than you. But it's in your best interest to recognize when that is, because then you can start tailoring your strategies to that. You know, you want to have a more high variance strategy against that type of player. Or if you're a football team, you know, a more high variance strategy in that game. And that can only come if you're honest with yourself and you're not. I mean, we see this with everybody. We see this with people. We see this with teams, organizations, right? The worst organizations in sports are the ones that have no idea who they actually are. they think their organization is good when it's not, and they continue to make the same mistakes over and over. I think really being honest with yourself and where you're at is the only way you're going to end up getting better.
I mentioned earlier, I think in passing, but I want to get more specifically into this. You had a tweet last year, a tweet storm, talking about zero RB, which is a fantasy football strategy, obviously. And you thought maybe the idea might be to have the one bell cow at the top of a draft. And you made a correlation. I wish I had the tweet storm in front of me, and I'll try to link to it so people can see it. Again, I thought it was such a wonderful discussion that it could have won an FSWA award on its own if they actually gave out such an award. Maybe Andy Behrens will come up with that. But can you talk about how you – the reason I'm bringing this up, other than the fact that it was a really interesting theoretical discussion, is you made some interesting comparisons between running backs in fantasy football and starting pitchers in fantasy baseball. So can you just talk a little bit about what that discussion was about?
Yeah, it was a while ago, but I think kind of the basis of it was that zero RB was becoming a really popular strategy in fantasy football. And people were like, oh, zero RB is so great. Like, it's this whole new thing. And if you've played fantasy baseball for a long time, and I have, and I know you have, you knew that people had already tried similar strategies in expert leagues in fantasy sports. You know, the Lima plan, the low investment mound aces plan. And I really saw this parallel between starting pitchers and running backs, and that starting pitchers are really volatile assets. They get hurt all the time. And when they do get hurt, they get hurt real bad. Like Tommy John surgery knocks you out for the year. This happens to running backs quite a bit too. And there's a lot of attrition at the top, but they're league winners. You know, when you have an ace starting pitcher, when you had Clayton Kershaw in his prime, he's the single best fantasy asset you can have. And it's the same thing with those running backs that are getting 300 plus touches, the guys that are, you know, getting 2000 total yards and 15, 20 touchdowns. There is no other player that can touch those stats. And so at some point, you know, the zero RB strategy is saying, oh, I'm not going to take this guy that's going to win my league. And I didn't necessarily agree with it. I think it can be right in some regards, but I just saw a lot of parallels between the running backs and the starting pitchers. And, you know, we'd seen people try this before in baseball, and it's like, okay, this is not a new thing. This is something that people have tried before, and here have kind of been the results from it. People who are trying this in fantasy football should kind of look at history and see how that's turned out. And yeah, I just saw parallels there, and I thought it was interesting. And I did not expect that tweet thread to blow up at all. I was just like, one day I was probably at work and bored, and I was just like, oh, I'll tweet this out. And it kind of caught on.
Yeah, I'll try to find it, and people can have a look at it. I know I shared that as much as I could, both on Twitter and in some of my email circles, because there was just so many good ideas there. Let me ask you, we're obviously in a time where home runs and strikeouts are all over the place, and it's been a challenge at times to find starting pitchers. At least I think it has been, although with pitching not being as effective in some ways, maybe we need less of it to be competitive. Have you done, I know you're more of a seasonal player than DFS player in baseball, and you're actually the other way in football, if I understand correctly. But I'm curious, have you gotten a handle on just where baseball's at? Have you changed any strategies? Do you have a takeaway about the 2019 season, especially as it presents itself to challenging us for trying to find good pitching?
Yeah, I mean, things have changed quite a lot. I mean, we know that strikeouts are way up. We know that power's way up. And we know that stolen bases, specifically this season, are way down. And so I think anytime you're in a draft, one of the biggest things you want to look at value-wise is not just how good a player is in a vacuum, but it's supply and demand. How many of this asset is there compared to like how good is it for my fantasy team? And I think that ace starting pitching is becoming more and more important in that regard, because I think there's just far fewer aces. You know, pitchers are not pitching as many innings as they used to. 200 inning starters are way down. And so I think it does increase the value of those stud starting pitchers even farther. Just like in football, you know, the bell cow running backs they're few and far between, because so many teams are splitting their backfields. And so the guys that do get 300 touches are even more valuable than they were before. You're never going to come out of a draft with a perfect team. That's not even the point of a draft. Throughout the year, guys will get hurt and you'll pick guys up. I think what you want to do in a draft, it's asset collection. And the best assets are the ones that are inherently valuable because of supply and demand. So, you know, this year I started most of my drafts with an ace pitcher. And I know that's not the most popular strategy, but for me, it was very important to pick up Garrett Cole, Justin Verlander, Max Scherzer, Jacob DeGrom. These were the guys I was targeting. And just like having that one stud running back, I'm fine to take one ace and then just mash hitting for a while. But in general, I just think you have to get an ace pitcher, or else you're way behind the game and you take on the risk that he gets hurt. That's all right. But you have to give yourself a chance to win, in my opinion.
I always feel like if you could talk to some fantasy god in the sky and they would grant you one perfect answer to a season, they'd say, okay, I'll tell you who the best fantasy pitcher will be this year or the best fantasy hitter. I'm not going to tell you both of them. You have to choose one. I would always ask for the pitcher. Easily. Just like if that option were given to me in football and say, okay, you know, you want to know who the best receiver is going to be, the best running back, or the best quarterback. I mean, you'd laugh at the quarterback. You never really worry about that position. But I'd say, tell me who the running back is, and then I will try to position myself where I have that person in as many leagues as possible. And it's the same thing with pitching. I remember one year I won a fantasy league where I had Miguel Cabrera at the time at the peak of his powers, and that's just so happened that's when Clayton Kershaw was at the peak of his powers. And as great as Miggy was, I concluded, and a lot of it is the shape of the league and where the categories are. Again, every situation is contextual, but I just thought that a dominant Kershaw would help me more than a dominant Cabrera. And I think it was one of Cabrera's triple crown years. I mean, he was, you know, a gigantic stat accumulator. And obviously there was some risk that, you know, maybe Kershaw would tire as the season went along. And the problem with pitchers is they have no floor. You know, a pitcher, when he gets hurt, and you mentioned just not just Tommy John surgery, sometimes they'll pitch poorly for a while, and then you find out they'll finally admit, okay, yeah, my shoulder's been barking, or my elbows hasn't been right, or whatever it is. So when a pitcher goes bad, I mean, they can really, really hurt you, where it seems like just as long as the offensive player stays in the lineup, I mean, look at Jose Ramirez. He's really picked it up the last month or so. But even when he wasn't hitting, at least he was stealing bases and providing you something. You know, granted, a huge loss player, but at least he was giving you enough reason to run him out there. Where when a pitcher goes bad, you know, I drafted Rick Porcello in a bunch of leagues. I mean, his ERA was like 6. I was afraid to play him, and right. I couldn't trade him. It's the worst possible thing you can have in fantasy is a player you don't really want to play, and you can't trade him to anybody, and you don't want to cut him. So you just end up staying on your roster and taking up bench space and standing in the way of anything you want to do. So I agree that the idea, and then again, the idea is, you know, you draft a starting pitcher and it doesn't work out, he gets hurt. You know, there's been some starting pitchers who haven't worked out this year, and it can leave a mark. But I think it's the idea of what gives me the best chance to win if it goes right. What gives me, I always feel this way during NCAA tournament time. I want to find the simplest plausible path to potentially winning my pool. And that's what I'm always trying to do in fantasy as well. Give me the simplest blueprint that if just these tiny amount of things go right, I have an excellent chance of winning.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think you brought up a good point about pitchers versus hitters. And when we're talking about the way that the league is changing, I think one of the things we've seen, power is obviously up, right? It is not necessarily up with the top guys. We're not going to see like 60 guys aren't hitting 60 home runs here. What we're seeing is a lot of power from the mid-tier guys go up. You know, we're seeing Max Kepler's hitting, you know, 30 plus already. I think he's like 28, something like that. But we're seeing a lot of power from that middle tier. You can now, I think, wait on hitting a little bit because you can get so much good hitting in the middle rounds. Whereas pitchers, I think what a lot of people do is that they take hitting early and then they think, shoot, I'm way behind in pitching. Now I'm going to take some pitchers. And they take those pitchers too early. Because of supply and demand. They don't want to get lost out, just like running backs all the time. Once you're past that first tier, the next tier tends to get overdrafted, in my opinion, because people are really looking for that guy that can take a step up when really he shouldn't be a third rounder. He should be more of a fifth or sixth. And so, yeah, I think that the way that the league changes, you're talking about Jose Ramirez, stolen bases are down. I mean, the guy's still giving you steals, and now obviously he's hitting better, but having steals these days is monster. That's the great thing about Christian Yelich. The home runs are great. The average is great. He steals a bunch of bases too. That's what makes him insanely valuable rather than just very good.
It's funny in the labor mixed league that I'm in, where my team really isn't going anywhere, I have Jonathan Villar on that team who has some power and he does run aggressively. And I end up making a trade with him. I was perfectly fine with the trade that I made. And as soon as I traded him, I actually unsolicited get a couple of other VR offers from people who didn't realize I had traded them, which reflects a couple of things. One, I had made one of the most one of the most novice mistakes you can make, which is trading an asset before you properly vet what its value is. And I, you know, a lot of times in this league, there isn't a lot of trading. So I think that's why I was hesitant to do that. But I mainly felt stupid for not maybe just kicking the tires on some people, looking categorically at somebody, say, look, VR might steal 20 bases for you. You could gain 6 points in the standings based on where you are right now. So I, that snapshot of where the league is at trying to solve that puzzle. But I think it's a case of, again, you know, you don't need as many steals overall to compete, but certain players who do things can have an impact that jump you in the standings. I talk about trading. We had a couple of trading podcasts with, I think, Fred Zinke, where one of the biggest mistakes you can make is not knowing your league and knowing how people feel about players and at least kicking some tires. So I didn't get that right. But I'm looking at your TG FBI roster right now, and you have a couple of guys that they're interesting to me. You mentioned Austin Riley, who was somebody who I'm sure you were early on to get him on your roster. You have Sin Soo Chu. I've tried to go younger with players in recent years, but I do have a soft spot in my heart for what I call the Ibanez All-Stars, for veteran players who are generally consistent, but because they're so boring, they tend to make for really nice values. And I know Joey Gallo is hurt right now, and maybe his second half is just going to be a mess because of the injury, but I thought he was an interesting upside play too, because we always knew the power was real and wasn't going away. But the idea that if he could just make a slight improvement and make his batting average palpable, I mean, what a great profit player he could be. So just some interesting guys on your roster, it seems like you hit on this year.
Yeah, I mean, those are actually really good players to point out, because they're two of my most rostered players around my portfolio. I mean, Chu is just one of those guys. The Raul Ibanez All-Star is just the perfect comp for him. I mean, he's just old. Nobody wants him. He was available, I forget what round, but he's always there in like the 15th round. I got him on almost every team this year. Not because I think he's a great player, but just because he's such a lock to outproduce most of the players going around him. Joey Gallo was a big breakout guy. You know, I look at a lot of different projection systems in the preseason, and the projection systems just love Joey Gallo. And there was a real easy path to profit. You're talking about your NCAA pools. Okay, if just this happens and this happens, how can things go right? For Joey Gallo, it was really just, if his batting average goes up 20 points, he's like a fourth round player. And he was returning that value. Obviously, he's dealt with some injury stuff, which is unfortunate, but I loved him. Looking at this team, I have Justin Turner and Ryan Braun on almost all my teams. Ryan Braun is kind of that Raul Ibanez all-star kind of guy as well. You could always get him in the double-digit rounds. Not an amazing MVP player like he used to be, but dude, he just puts up good stats all the time. He's a good player. He provides some power, some speed, things like this. And so being prepared for your drafts and like having certain guys that you know you want to get later, I think really helps out. And so those Bronze and those Chews, I mean, they're on like all my teams.
Yeah, I tend to think that there used to be 20 years ago a scouting advantage in fantasy where I think even by reading the USA Today notes, you could be ahead of people. Or when I first was on Prodigy, oh, I have a friend from Minnesota. He's telling me, he's giving me reports on Randy Moss rookie year. He scored 7 touchdowns yesterday in practice. Get Randy Moss. I know he's the third receiver, and teams at the time didn't use third receivers, but just draft this guy. He was begging me. I feel like the information advantage has just been mitigated so much because there's so many good websites, and a lot of them are free websites that will, even the weakest owner in your league will have good information in front of him, a good cheat sheet in front of him. And I think the way we win our leagues now is more about the meta of what's underserved in my room. What are the biases at play in this league? Sometimes you're not going to know. You may be playing with a bunch of randoms, just like you step into a poker game. It may be regulars you know. It may be people you don't know, and you try to piece together things based on their behavior. How are they dressed? How are they acting? How are their chips aligned? It's funny how many personality tells you can pick up just by looking at somebody and looking at a couple of things that usually line up. But I think to be a winning fantasy player now, I mean, look, you need to know your player pool. Unquestionably, you need to be up on news. I get that. But I feel like 10, 15, 20 years ago, if you were really newsy, you could just beat people that way. And now I think it's more about how we play and how we exploit biases in leagues that we actually do well.
I completely agree with this. I mean, I don't even know if I have anything to add because it's just so accurate. I mean, everybody knows everything now. Anything you want to find, you can go on Yahoo and read something. You guys provide a ton of free content that's been good for decades. You can go on Twitter and just find like news reports and people, you know, posting all this crazy information. You have to do way less work these days in terms of player profiling, things like that. I just use like projection systems that are free. I mean, it's like I used to do my own projections, and it's like, oh, look, like, you know, the Bat and Steamer, they do way better than I could ever do. And I can just like copy and paste them here. But I completely agree. Now, the skills that you need to win are different. It's way more game theory than it is like, you know, projecting and knowing players. Everybody knows who the good players are. It's how do we put these together into something cohesive? How do we understand where the value is, where the supply and demand is? All those things are really key these days.
I'm going to ask you one more question, and then we're going to get into our Rounders draft. Try to keep this answer a little bit tight, so we'll have plenty of time to share in the joy of Rounders. You mentioned, and I think I mentioned this earlier in the pod, you're more of a DFS than seasonal guy in fantasy football. You're more of a seasonal than DFS guy in fantasy baseball. Can you just explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I've played seasonal fantasy baseball for 20 years. It'll probably be my first and biggest love always. But I think, you know, in the theme that we were talking about before, fantasy baseball, DFS-wise, has really become a battle of projection systems. You just see a lot of players using the same projection systems. I think it has taken some of the fun out of it as we get more efficient, right? It's not necessarily a bad thing, but we see this in real baseball also. The game has become more efficient, maybe a little less aesthetically pleasing. But that's kind of what's happened to DFS baseball, in my opinion, is it's like a battle of projection systems. I don't think there's as much nuance or fun to it. Whereas fantasy football, I think the format of DFS is absolutely perfect for fantasy football. But number two, I think there's a lot more art to it than science. And I still really enjoy that. And then B, I mean, there's still a lot of money. Fantasy football is king, and I think there's more money to be made in DFS football. So that's something I really focus on. You know, seasonal football leagues, there's a lot of luck inherent in them. There's a lot of luck. Whereas DFS, sure, there's luck, but I think there's a lot less when you're doing it on a week by week basis. So for that reason, I love DFS football, and DFS baseball is, it's okay, but I don't spend as much time on it these days.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the better player will win more often in DFS football versus seasonal football. Of course, I'll always play both of them and enjoy both of them. And of course, fantasy baseball, I often say that the weakest owner in your fantasy baseball league, even with the advantages of the internet and how great Fangraphs is and all these other aggregating sites, you know, it's an age of enlightenment in a lot of ways, but the weakest owner in a fantasy baseball league probably won't win. When I think anybody who sits down at a fantasy football draft, they only need a couple things to go right, even if they're accidentally things that go right, and they could win their league. So it's not good or bad. It's just it's the fact that they happen to be different.
Yeah, it is what it is. We had a guy in one of my leagues a couple years ago win with the fewest points in the league. Like, he just lucked his way into a 7-7 record and snuck into the playoffs and then beat everybody in the playoffs. Lowest points in the entire league. And I think everybody has that story. And it's like, did the best team actually win? No. Seasonal fantasy baseball, the best team does generally win.
And I'll just quickly say, if you're looking, and look, nothing wrong with having, if you want to have a simple league with people who maybe want to do it more casually, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you want to add more strategy and skill to your league, big believer in adding more starting spots. You smooth out variance a little bit that way. I'm a big super flex proponent. And I also like adding, remember, playoffs are totally customizable in Yahoo. So you can have people get into the playoffs, not just by one loss record, because head-to-head's generally more fun, but total points generally more fair. Why not give a couple of playoff spots to teams that score a lot of points that don't otherwise qualify? That's something we've done in my leagues for a long time. For a while, we used to kind of had to hack the system to get into it. But now Yahoo allows full customizability to your playoff brackets. So things to consider. And, you know, again, it works for fantasy baseball, too. Why not add an extra flex spot or an extra outfielder? Yeah, you might say, well, who am I going to put in there? You know, the player pool isn't good enough. Well, everybody will have a mediocre player in there. But the point is, that means outlier performances will mean less because we have more going into the total pool of stats that we're collecting. We're talking to the great Sammy Reed. I'm so thrilled that we got him on today. We're talking poker, we're talking game theory, and now we're going to talk Rounders. We're going to transition into our draft. There's a lot of movies that I think are rewatchable. I think Rounders is the number one rewatchable movie for me. We did a draft earlier this year, I think with Derek Carty. We did our favorite movies of the last 20 years, and Rounders was my number one pick. There's a lot of movies I love, but man, Rounders is right near the top of it. I don't think I've ever passed it when it's on my TV, when it's on the cable or the dish, or God knows every time I'm at poker, somebody's talking about it or quoting it, usually doing a bad KGP imitation. I know this draft is a little bit wonky. We have no rules for this. We're just going to draft things about Rounders, things we love about Rounders. and they can be as big or as small or as important or as quirky as we want them to be. Sammy Reed, you have the first pick in our Rounders draft.
All right. Well, I would be remiss if I did not take Teddy KGB with the first pick. We can do some bad KGB impressions if we want, but I think he's the most memorable character of this movie, right? He's the one that everybody imitates and says his lines, and he's only in the movie for like 5 minutes. He has this ridiculous over-the-top Russian accent, but to me, every one of his lines is just obscenely quotable. Like, there's very few poker sessions you'll play where some guy is not saying, you know, hanging around. Like, everybody quotes this guy. And I think you leave the movie and you're like, yeah, Teddy KGB. Like, that's the guy.
Kid's got alligator blood. Yeah, I can't say enough how Brian Koppelman and David Levine just crushed the feel of poker and the sound of poker. And the dialogue is so good in this movie. And obviously KGB, as you said, in a movie that's an, you know, why are movies rewatchable? Because they're quotable, because they're relatable. And I don't know how relatable KGB is, although I guess we're all afraid of somebody at the poker table, it seems like. It's certainly, you know, Russian mobsters have always scared me, but yeah, it's a great pick.
He's like not that menacing for a Russian mobster, is he? He's like kind of a little bit of a caricature.
Right, right. Never... Well, Mike says he doesn't look like much, but he's connected all the way up to the top of the Russian mob. Right. Yeah, so he admits that, look, you know, the guy's over there chewing his Oreos, but he's the one guy in the game you don't want to, I'll say, mess with. A great pick in the first round.
And the one time he gets mad, he's like, in my club, I'll splash the pot whenever the F I please. You know, he's just like, and you know, Mikey's like, yeah, okay, I got it.
So great. Great pick in our first round. The first thing I'm going to say about things I love about Rounders is I'm going to say the relationship between Mike and Worm. Pretty much every scene between Mike and Worm, the movie's a conflict about Mike, who's kind of a poker degen, who's trying to go straight. He had the big loss. And by the way, if you haven't seen Rounders, we're going to spoil the heck out of it. So I'm not going to apologize for that. The movie came out in 1998, for crying out loud.
Yeah, you better have seen it by now.
Yeah, you should have seen it by now. I'm wondering when Criterion's going to put out an edition, because I think it's definitely worthy of that. Wasn't particularly successful at the box office at the time. That was just a timing thing. I mean, Moneymaker comes 5 years later. I imagine if Rounders had come out right before that, I mean, it would have been a huge hit, but at least it's been in the residuals. The writers and the people who made the movie have gotten the due that they deserve. To me, the soul of the movie is Mike and Worm's relationship. Again, Mike's a degen trying to go straight. Worm has taken the hit for Mike, been in prison for a while. So Mike feels like he owes something to Worm, but Worm is still completely a degenerate and is just going to screw up Mike's life in every way he can. And every scene, you know, they're in the Jeep going to the game that Worm, by the way, who's been in the joint for a while, but knows it's a poker game that night, which is just outstanding. But that's a great discussion. They get the argument at the YMCA gym or the church gym, whatever that is, when they get beat up. And Worm looks at him. Worm's just gotten them beaten up by a bunch of cops. And he said, you should have played those kings, Mike. Just showing what a jerk he is. Right. And, you know, Worm is saying, you know, why are all you know, Mike, why are you the noble guy? And I'm always the jerk, you know. And they have a great discussion, which shows the personalities they are, how they see this situation differently, how they both have different ways of solving the problem. And where Mike finally realizes, I got to cut this guy off. The only way I'm going to be able to fix this is if I drop Worm. Every Mike and Worm scene, this is the movie, all the scenes I love. There's only a couple of things I could really nitpick about this movie, and I don't even want to do that because I love it so much. But to me, the soul of the movie is the relationship between Mike and Worm.
And two really wonderful actors. You know, you talked about this movie not being that great commercial-wise, but think of the cast in this movie. I mean, Matt Damon and Ed Norton at like kind of their height. I mean, this is right around the time both of them were getting really big. You have John Turturro and Femke Janssen and Martin Landau. And I mean, just all these great actors, John Malkovich. And I, you know, it's such a niche movie, you know, poker wasn't so mainstream at the time, but the acting in this movie is really incredible and the actors are great. And you can really feel that chemistry between all of them.
Great. All right. You're up in the second round.
All right. The second round, I am taking the poker montage. When Mikey tries to go and win, he's like, I'm going to play it straight. I'm going to win all the money. And he goes to all those different places, you know, all those backroom games. They're not even playing with chips. They're just playing with cash. And, you know, they're in a restaurant. They're in a gymnasium. And I love this montage. For me, it's like up there with the montages from like Rocky and Wedding Crashers and the Pai Mei montage in Kill Bill 2. It's like my favorite montages of all time. I mean, I love when, you know, he's playing against that guy and he looks at him and he goes, "Nope, you didn't do it this time. I'm going to raise you." And the guy's just like, "I fold." And, you know, there's that great line. They're playing in the restaurant and, you know, he's like, "Ah, three aces." And the other guy's like, "I just have a pair of jacks." His buddy goes, does this look like a man beaten by jacks? You know, it's just the whole montage is amazing. And to me, it's like one of the most rewatchable parts of the movie.
Oh, I love that montage too. And there's so many things they get right. Remember, Mike's not playing Hold'em in a lot of these games. You know, he's playing all these different versions of poker. And if you were in the situation they were in, where you're trying to go on a rush and collect some money for some bad people you owe money to, you would go anywhere you could. You'd go to a diner and you'd play high-low games and you'd play, you know, as many hobbyists as you could at poker to try to take advantage of them. And just they get the feel, they get the sound of it so right. And what they're going through.
They got the music going and, you know, he's like, "Oh, you know, you play one 60-hour session and you're burnt out, you know, you wuss." It's great.
Right. And I even love the scene where they're shaving. I always wondered if they did that because they wanted to shoot certain scenes and the guys should have had a 3-day growth by then and they wouldn't. So I wonder if that's part of the reason why they're shaving. But Mike's like, I feel like I'm going to get whacked.
Right. Which,
not untrue. Great scene. For a second, I thought you were going to draft, although that's an excellent pick, what I want to draft now in the second round, which is the opening scene of the movie. And when you say opening scene, the rounders, everybody thinks about Mike against KGB and Mike losing all his money. But I'm actually talking about the first 90 to 120 seconds of the movie where the opening titles come on and Mike's in his apartment. His lawyer, law school girlfriend is falling asleep with a book on her lap, which is what law school students probably do all the time. And, you know, Mike shuts the light, closes the book and goes to all this money, all these rolls of cash that are hidden in his apartment, in poker materials, in books. He has some money hidden in a cigar box where he probably has a pack of cigarettes he's not supposed to smoke, a couple of odd chips from poker rooms. Anybody who plays poker knows what that's like. I have all sorts of trinkets I've collected unintentionally or intentionally from poker rooms that are just sitting in a bowl in my kitchen. I don't have, you know, $30,000 like Mike did, but I know what it's like to maybe have a couple of bills squirreled away here or there. I love that scene. It's a callback to Doyle Brunson and Super System. It's a callback to Mike Caro and his great book on tells. There's a video of the 1988 World Series, which shows up later in the movie. Yeah, there's a horseshoe in his apartment. Again, the money tucked behind the artwork. It's all rolled up in $100 bills. Mike's not going there with 20s and 10s. You know, he's only got C notes with him with the rubber bands. Everything about that scene makes me want to go play, but it makes me want to drop everything I'm doing. I don't care if it's 2 a.m. and find a poker game.
100%. It just really captures the mood. Like you said, it pays a lot of homage to some of the greats in poker, you know, showing Super System and Mike Caro's Book of Tells. And, you know, I think the thing that really caps this off is that opening line, right? The one, I think it's probably the most iconic line of the movie where he just says, "Look, the thing is this. If you can't spot the sucker within the first 30 seconds, the first 30 minutes at your table, then you are the sucker." And that's, you know, that ties into like that whole beginning. And that's like, you're watching this movie and immediately you're like, "Okay, I'm in. I'm fully in." And it just grabs you. And I love that opening sequence for sure.
Good stuff. Yeah. Third round, Sammy Reed, you're up.
So my third round pick is going to be the scene in the bar between Martin Landau and Mikey, the professor and Mikey, where the professor tells the story of eschewing becoming a rabbi so he could work in law. And I just love everything about the scene. You talk about the chemistry between Worm and Mikey. I think there's amazing chemistry here between Martin Landau and Matt Damon. And, you know, Martin Landau tells the whole story and then Mikey asks him, "If you had to do it all over again, would you make the same choices?" And Martin Landau, he's just so great. And he looks at him and he just says, "What choice? We can't run from who we are. Our destiny chooses us." And this scene is really great personally for me because there was definitely a point in my life where when I had decided I was going to play online poker for a living, I sat down with my mom at her dinner table. And my mom is a very successful person. She's a highly educated partner in a law firm. And I told her, "I'm going to play poker for a living." And that took a lot of courage for me to do because my mom expects big and different things from me. And I really felt Martin Landau in that moment. And I just thought it's an amazing scene. I love when, you know, he's drinking and he says, you know, have a drink with me. And, you know, what are we drinking? Gin, always gin. Everything about Martin Landau in this scene is amazing. And I just absolutely love it.
I love that gin always. I don't know why. Every time somebody mentions gin, gin comes up in any conversation, I'll just go gin, always gin. And I don't care if nobody gets it. If one person out of 100 gets it, I'm happy. But
right. It's the only time I've ever wanted gin in my life, by the way.
Right. I don't even play the card game. You know, I'm not in on gin other than if Martin Landau is drinking it, I would drink it too. The late Martin Landau, what a great actor he was. And perfectly cast. And you need that relationship to be important because you need to buy in. I don't want to get hung up on the credibility of it, but you need to believe that this guy would actually loan Mike a sizable sum of money on spec at the end of the movie or near the end of the movie. It's important that relationship be cared for and textured and nuanced, and it certainly is. And the casting, I don't know the casting director off the top of my head, but man, did they totally nail that. In the third round, I'm going to pick the talk of poker, just the talk at the tables and, you know, the guys in New Jersey playing each other and all making fun of each other. And one of the guys saying, Worm, do they allow people like you in places like this? And, you know, Knish obviously has no use for Worm and he's saying sarcastic things. And you can see when Mike loses his role in the first scene, you can see one of the players looks at Mike like, you just screwed up the game. Thanks a lot. You know, just the tone, we're leaving. The texture, this the game's feel. Over. Yeah, poker is the greatest sounds anyway. With, you know, the chips, the sound they make and everything. Although, interesting, I don't remember anybody shuffling chips. Every table I'm at now, somebody's really good at it. I'm like a C+, B- shuffler. I can do it a little bit. But I always am instantly a little bit intimidated by the people who can do the tricks. I think it's important to have a way to relax you and it just looks cool. But they get the feel of poker right. And so much of that is the sound, is the people making fun of each other, is the cutting up. You know, Mike... one time Worm, when he's in that game with those Russian guys and they're talking in Russian, he goes, hey, look, you want to see the seventh card, the river? You're going to stop speaking Sputnik. And not only do I love that line because it's just an awesome line, but I believe I've heard somewhere that Ed Norton actually ad-libbed that wasn't in the script, and Norton came up with it. And it's perfect. It's delivered with the perfect amount of alacrity and sarcasm. Yeah. As by the way, Worm is cheating them for every cent they have, you know. But, correct. You know, look, he thinks, look, maybe sure they're working as partners.
Just talking about pierogies and stuff.
Pierogies, you know, and snow, right? But yeah, cut the crap. So right. I love the sound of the games, the sound of the tables. Man, did they nail it. That's my third round pick.
Ah, that's a great pick. They really nailed the whole feel of poker. You know, all the, especially the back rooms. You know, the whole movie has this kind of dark, grainy feel to it, you know, low lit and you know, all the scenes are like that. It's really amazing. So
yeah, it's like a noirish film. And you know, people, to a lot of people listening who don't know poker that well, they may think poker is the World Series, is, you know, the main event. This is not about any tournament style. This is about literally the grinding of doing it in the back alleys. You know, this is Teddy KGB's place. You won't find it in the yellow pages. It's about the underground scene of poker. And again, a very noirish feel from John Dahl, the director.
Absolutely. For my fourth round pick, I am going to kind of piggyback on what you said, but a little off the opening scene. You know, you were talking about that very first 90 to 100 seconds. For me, it's the rest of that scene, you know, when Mikey gets busted, when, you know, he gets shown those aces full, the way Teddy KGB puts in his chips, you're right, I don't have the spades, you know, and he says, I know before the cards are even turned up. And that look on Mikey's face when he gets busted, I mean, for me, this is great acting, because if you've ever been cold decked in a big pot, you know that feeling, and you felt the exact same way. This is him relating to you as a poker player and you buying in that, you know, he's just absolutely gotten murked in this pot. And it doesn't just mean something for the game. It means something for him personally. This is a big hit to him personally. And this really resonates throughout the film. It really, you know, ties into, you know, his relationship with his girlfriend, his relationship with Worm, his relationship to poker, his relationship to KGB, Knish. But it sets up that final scene with KGB. It means so much. And the way, you know, his face just looks and drops, and then he's outside talking to Knish, and he's just like, bro, that was my whole role. Like, I'm down to the felt. Knish is like, well, I got the truck. You know, this really just sets up the movie so well. And I think the poker scenes, all of them in this movie are fantastic. I think this is one of the best. That feeling of just pure deflation, Matt Damon just really captures it.
Yeah, they really sell the stomach punch. He looks like his life has just taken this dramatic turn. He just got the crap kicked out of him. And it's he looks overwhelmed. He looks like somebody has just unleashed on his stomach and he can't breathe. And man, did they sell it well. That's a great pick. And I love Down to the Fell. Again, this movie just has all the right language, all the right texture with that. You know, he could have said, I'm busted, but I'm down to the felt. That's how a poker player would talk. I'm going to take Knish in the fourth round, the character Knish. Just the conscience of Rounders. I think Chris Ferguson said he was the true hero of Rounders. Knish was the example of how you could win if you play it smart but conservative. But also Knish in some ways also reflects that maybe you don't want to go down that path. Maybe, you know, as Mike says, if you play life too conservatively, your whole life can become a grind. So is Knish a pattern for him? Is he somebody he wants to emulate, somebody he wants to become someday? You're using the playbook that Knish set up off his own beats? Or is he somebody that Mike can't really see him being? Maybe he wants to become a different poker pro or not a pro at all. I also love that Knish is impressed by the story that Mike tells him late in the movie where Mike has met up with Johnny Chan. I'm not sure how well they can really kind of develop that Mike made a move on Chan in a limit game. But I mean, I'm not gonna,
right, right.
Again,
I'm well, gonna, I four-bet him and he folded getting,
yeah,
you know,
I four-bet him and he folded. You know, and also, by the way, in the judges game, somebody would have called that raise. In a limit game, somebody would have, just to keep you honest, called that raise. You know,
yeah, these guys aren't making good folds.
Such a recreational game. Yeah, there's no way that scene is a little bit. And I know Brian Koppelman would say, well, look, I've talked to Hellmuth. He can do that. You know, he can be in a game and, you know, for just a minute and call people's hands cold. But to call everybody's hands cold and not get somebody to spitefully call you, I think might be man, I hate saying this. I love Rounders so much, man. I don't want to say bad things about it. But I love how Knish is impressed that Mike encountered Chan and won a big pot from Chan, but he still isn't loaning the money.
Right. Anyway, he's telling him to screw off, and then Mikey tells him the story, and he's like, go on. You had aces, wired aces, wired kings. And he's like, nah, rags. And Knish is in.
Right. Totally in. And the way Turo, the way his face is tilted and the way he's engaged and the way that scene is shot, it's like, you pulled a move on Chan. You know, at one point he said, I don't doubt your talent. You know, Knish respects him, but he also realizes he has to make the life choice of not giving Mike this money. No, I give it to you. What am I buying you, a day? I'm wasting it. He's like, you know, you need the truck, place to stay, no problem. You want me to talk to some people, buy you some time, I will. But if it's not the money, I got to say no. Anyway, Knish, based on a real character named Bagel, and Brian Koppelman wrote a eulogy for Bagel, who died a few years ago. You can still find that, I think, on Grantland if you do search on Koppelman and Bagel. Knish, my fourth round pick.
That's such a good pick. Like, you know, you really see this, like, angel, which is Knish on one shoulder, and, you know, Ed Norton worm on the other shoulder, perfect. The devil. You know, you really see this, but Knish is so well done because he's so understated. He's so kind of beat down, and everything he says is really quiet. And, you know, he's just like, Knish, how are you doing? The same. You know, everything about it. Yeah, everything about his character is so perfect. And, yeah, Turturro really nails him here.
A little bit low on time, so we're going to go speed round in the fifth round. You are up. Final pick.
Great. That's great because mine is very, very quick. It is a single quote from Worm in the poker game of life. Poker women of are life. The rake, right? Wait, what saying? Well, I don't know, but there ought to be one. That's it. That's probably my favorite line from the movie.
Awesome.
That's my fifth
round
pick.
Not only is what Worm says great, but Mike's reaction. He's immediately offended that Worm is making up this stuff. Well, what saying? And Worm completely backs off. Well, I don't know. There ought to be one. In a movie that has so many great lines, man, that's really near the top. In the speed round, fifth round, I want to pick something silly. Man, what a great pick that is. I'm so glad somebody brought that up. I'm going to bring up just the names of the golf of the poker games they don't go to, or I guess they go to some of them. But when Mike is trying to tell Worm to go straight and playing all the soft games, he goes, you know, playing the dentist game, playing the golf pro game. You know, I just wonder, you know, who are these dentists who are just, you know, throwing away money left and right because they have no idea what they're doing. They're great if you need a molar filled, you know, molar removed or a filling, you know, done, or a teeth cleaning. But, you know, you get them in a game of no limit. You got to take them for, you know, 2 weeks of pay. Playing the dentist game. Go out to Suburbia. They do go play in the golf pro game. Mike gets bluffed out of a big pot. But I just love that.
Yeah, that one sounds good. That's a soft one. I'll do that.
Right, yeah, I'll definitely get to do that. You know, I just love that there's a circuit of all these, you know, it's almost like a speakeasy feel, you know. It's not a bar with a sign on it. Again, it's not in the Yellow Pages. It's just something you have to know about. You have to be in the club. You just feel like you're an insider to this world, and man, do they do a great job with that. And when I say insider, that makes me think Fantasy Insider. We've been so lucky to have Sammy Reed on the show today. Sammy, tell people how they can keep up with you.
On Twitter, at SammyReedFI, doing work, a little bit of Fantasy Insiders and at Roto Grinders, do a column for them, and podcasting. And yeah, man, this was just a ton of fun. I'm really happy that we did this, and it was great.
Yeah, this was so much fun. If you like the podcast, why not give us a rating and a review on iTunes or one of your other podcast aggregators? Sammy, I expect him to be great. He's hit it out of the park. Not surprised at all by that. For Sammy Reed, for our producer, Brett Rader, keeping us on the air and sounding great, I am Scott Pianowski. We'll be back with another great guest next week. Already booked. Really excited about him. Somebody you will know pretty well. Until then, keep grinding, man. Keep earning that rent money. It's very noble, your stuff that you're doing. And we will see you on the felt. We'll talk to you soon.